Reverend Barber, I want to thank you for being with us. Thank you for all you're doing. And friends on the call, my name is Roger Hickey. I'm co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. I want to thank Dave Johnson for organizing this this call. And my job is, I'm honored to introduce Reverend Dr. William Barber II. He is the leader of North Carolina NAACP, and this is an opportunity for you to hear about the remarkable Moral Mondays movement, which he also leads, and to understand better the reason for what looks to be a huge demonstration in Raleigh on February 8th. People in North Carolina are calling it the Moral March on Raleigh. They've invited people from out of state to join them, and we hope that you on the call will both write about the march beforehand and, if you can, be in Raleigh on February 8th. Now, you all know how Pat McCrory, the current governor, and North Carolina Republicans took over the legislature and the governor's office with the help of ultra-wealthy and ultra-right-wing political operator Art Pope and, of course, the Tea Party. And almost immediately, the General Assembly eliminated over 5,000 teaching positions, over 4,000 teacher assistants. They cut pre-K classes for 30,000 preschoolers, and they diverted $10 million to a school voucher program. They terminated unemployment benefits for 170,000 out-of-work North Carolinians, and they denied Medicaid to 500,000 qualified recipients. They abolished the earned income tax credit for almost a million working class residents of the state. And at the same time, or shortly thereafter, they reduced taxes for the top 5% in the state. And then, to insulate themselves from voters, the Republican legislature passed the most restricted ballot access laws in the nation, specifically targeting minority voters. Now, many people think Reverend Barber rose up from nowhere to rally these tens of thousands of white and black citizens who have joined the weekly Moral Mondays demonstrations at the Capitol. They've had over 400 people arrested for civil disobedience. Actually, Reverend Barber has been working for years as both a profound scholar and a charismatic preacher to prepare for this moment. He invigorated the NAACP. He built a network of activists for what he hopes will be the last effort to win back the South for an interracial democracy. And now, even as the good guys in Congress are leaving out North Carolina and Georgia from the most important voter rights sections of the new voting rights bill, Moral Mondays movements are springing up in Georgia and South Carolina and other places in the South and in the nation. So this is an amazing and important moment. I am honored to introduce to you Reverend Dr. Barber to talk to you for about 10 minutes, and then we'll open up for questions. Reverend Barber?
Thank you so much, Roger. Thank you so much for this opportunity. I'm so humbled and honored. And on behalf of the tens of thousands of people in the Forward Together Moral Movement, I want to thank all of the bloggers who are on at this time. You know, 146 years ago, when blacks and whites came together in the South Carolina and North Carolina to come up out of the ugly history of slavery, they started writing a new vision. One part of that vision in our own Constitution that survives to today says all political power is vested in and derived from the people, and all government of right originates from the people and is founded upon their will only, and is instituted solely for the good of the whole. That is one of our deepest constitutional values. From our faith perspective, my Jewish friends would tell you, and Christian brothers would also agree with this, that Isaiah 10 says, "Woe unto those who make unjust laws, who issue oppressive decrees that deride the poor of their rights." And of course, me being a Christian pastor, I pastor at Greenlee Christian Church in Goldsboro, one of the common themes in our church is that for nations and for governments, as that we're called to do for the least of these. And that's not just about private charity, but it's about how we shape public policy. For the past 7 years, a fusion movement, and I'd like to, someone asked me a question, they could talk about how where I think we are in terms of a third reconstruction, but we've used the model of a fusion movement that's been growing. In 2006, we formed the historic Thousand Oaks General Street People's Coalition. It's now over 160 coalition partners. And every year, this fusion movement comes together on the second Saturday in February to hold a mass people's assembly to reaffirm our commitment to the 14-point agenda that the people can find at www.hkomj.com. We did it not to be Democrat or Republican, because we have no permanent friends or permanent interests, only permanent issues, but to talk about a broader and deeper conversation about public policy that's rooted in our deepest moral values and our deepest constitutional values. This year, we will have the Moral March on Raleigh and the HKOJ People's Assembly, and it takes place in the wake of the diligent efforts of thousands of people of goodwill in 2013 who drove across the state to Raleigh to make a weekly witness against the cruel, immoral, and unconstitutional policies of Governor Pat McCrory, Speaker Tom Tillis, who now wants to be a senator, and Senate Leader Phil Berger, and Budget Director Kingmaker Art Pope, who has put $50 million of his own money funding extremist and right-wing organizations in North Carolina. We are responding to their attack on the poor, the sick, children, education, unemployment, and voting rights. 941 people of all different races, creeds, colors, and incomes were arrested because we refused to give up our First Amendment right of freedom of speech. We come now with love and faith and commitment and tenacity to this year's Moral March on February the 8th. We are believing that it will be the largest march since Selma when Dr. King made the call. We recognize in this state that if you're going to change America, you've got to change the South. And if you're going to change the South, you've got to change state by state. And what we need now is indigenous-led, locally-led, deeply moral, deeply constitutional, broad-based, agenda-driven, fusion-based coalition models to grow up in every state that are taking on the actions of these extremists and regressive people in our state houses. We need direct action. We need nonviolent direct action. We need litigation. We need grassroots voter education and empowerment. And this must be on a state-by-state basis. This is the way we can, in fact, change the South and, in fact, change America. The Moral March on Raleigh is a part of our anti-racist, anti-poverty, pro-labor, deeply moral, forward together movement. It has great diversity, solidarity. Thousands will stand against extremist policies passed by the government legislature. Last year, they had their time to vote and abuse power. They had their chance to violate the constitutional principle of the good of the whole and the biblical principle of caring for the least of these. This year, we will vote with our voices and our votes to show the power of the people. So on February 8, 2014, 9:30 in the morning, we will gather at Shaw University on South Street between Wilmington Street and Blunt Street. And then we will march together to the state capitol right in front of it on Fayetteville Street, and afterwards we will have a mass people's assembly. At that people's assembly, at the Moral March and People's Assembly, we will lay out in detail what we call our 5M grassroots mobilization plan. One, this will not be a moment, it is a movement, and we will call on the thousands who join us. Number one, to motivate every citizen to be involved by maintaining our appeal all year to their deepest moral and constitutional values as to why they should be engaged in the fight against extreme, mean-spirited public policy that hurts and attacks the poor, the sick, women, people of color, immigrants, the LGBT community, and more. Two, we will meet every challenge to suppress the right to vote. Three, we will mobilize strategically, county by county, very targeted way, every person to be educated on the issues and get to the polls and vote. Four, we will make every effort to fight in the courts against all efforts to undermine the vote. We are working with the Advancement Project and fighting the monster voter suppression bill, and we're going to be challenging our Congress to restore Section 5 and knowing that Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, knowing that nothing less will settle up for us than to ensure that North Carolina, Alabama, South Carolina, and Virginia are included. And number five, we will move every obstacle attempted to keep citizens from voting. Right now, we are planning on the first weekend in February to have more than 50 churches, mosques, and synagogues who will preach and call people out to the Moral March on Raleigh from their pulpit and will invite media and bloggers to come into those sanctuaries. I'm also now on a 15-stop tour across the state where we are calling for the people to join us at this Moral March. We also, on February 3rd, which is the first Monday in February, we will hold a policy briefing entitled The Lost and Cost Briefing, where we will have scholars, community experts, and policy leaders lay out the moral cost, economic cost, political cost, and social cost, by the way, which we connect all together, of the extreme and regressive laws and policies passed by Governor McCrory's extreme legislature and backed by Budget Director Art Pope. On the 7th of February, we will have a pre-Moral March ecumenical service. And then on the February the 8th, people will come from all over. We are saying that if you believe in a nonviolent moral movement, if you believe that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, as Dr. King said, if you understand that what happens in North Carolina has implications for the future of this nation, and if you believe we can build a moral movement together to save the soul of our state and country, then regardless of party, creed, sex, race, or income, we invite you to come and to join us. We are calling on people of conscience to join us as we stand against this extreme going on in our state. We know that they chose North Carolina as a crucible, as a testing ground, because in some ways, if they can get away with this in a progressive state like North Carolina, it pours rain and depression on the rest of the states throughout the South. What the basis of the Moral Monday and why we have framed the language in terms of moral and constitutional, not liberal versus progressive or Republican versus Democrat, is because language needs to be open and broad enough and liberating enough to bring people in. 16% of the people who have marched with us in Moral Monday have been Republicans. Many people have come together. I've even gone to Mitchell County that's 99% white, 89% Republican, and the Republican chair renounced the party there, saying he's not this kind of extremist Republican, but more like a Lincoln Republican. This broad kind of language, this language, is critical. We've never had any major movement in America that didn't have a deep moral center and a deep constitutional center. It also allows people to come together, again, all different kinds of people to come together and fight against this dangerous extremist and ultra-conservative push. This is how we frame this language. We believe that it is constitutionally inconsistent, morally indefensible, and economically insane to make it more difficult for citizens to vote, to pass a voter suppression bill that's the worst that we've seen since Jim Crow, to engage in regressive redistricting that's the worst that we've seen since the 19th century, to try to stop early voting and Sunday voting and same-day registration, and to place into law voter ID that is a violation, we believe, of our Constitution, and even the 24th Amendment, which is anti-poll taxes. It is constitutionally inconsistent, morally indefensible, and economically insane to cut Medicaid for 500,000 people in a state that has 1.6 million poor people, many of them children, and will not only hurt them and will cause 2,800 people to die this year, but also will cost this state thousands of jobs over the next few years. It's extreme. It's constitutionally inconsistent, morally indefensible, and economically insane to raise taxes on 900,000 poor and middle-class people so that you can give 23 families a tax cut. To raise taxes on 20 people making $25,000, but cut taxes on people making $250,000. We believe it's extreme to end unemployment benefits for 170,000 people who lost their jobs with no fault of their own. It's extreme to resegregate our school, defund public education in North Carolina because now we're lower per pupil than Mississippi, to drop 30,000 children from preschool, and to cut 5,000 teachers and 4,000 teacher assistants. And we believe that it is extreme to attack women's rights and attack LGBT rights and attack labor union rights. This is constitutionally inconsistent, morally indefensible, and economically insane. And that is why we frame this as a moral movement, because that kind of language actually gives a place where people can come together who may not have already been together, because they can see that this is not Republicanism. This is not Democrat. This is an extremist. This is Tea Party extremism times two on steroids, and that's why we have to challenge it. We are called finally to a deeply moral and constitutional vision of society. We have to look at policy through the moral lens of justice for all and through the constitutional principle of the common good. We have created a movement that has benefited from the changing demographics in the South, which is why we believe we're in the middle of a third Reconstruction. We are bringing together a unified coalition around shared values that cut across race, class, and gender. And we're not doing it from a perspective of depression. We understand that extremists are scared. They see the demographics changing. They see people coming together. And the only way they can hold together the solid South and to hold together the so-called white Southern strategy and cause white Southerners to vote against their own interests is to keep us from each other and to try to press and push this extreme agenda. We are fighting against it because we know that things can in fact change. The demographics say they can change. The issues say they can change. And the energy says they can change. When we started this movement, the governor was over 50% in the poll. After we exposed what he's doing that's constitutionally inconsistent, morally indefensible, and economically insane, he's now under 30%. The legislature was at 40%, now they're under 19%. And Moral Monday is catching fire all over the state, and this new language and new way of moving is pulling us together. A part of our goal must be to destroy one of the greatest myths of our time. And that is the notion that extreme policies harm a small subset of people, such as people of color, or women, or the LGBT community, or the immigrant community. The reality is, when we look at this from a deeply moral perspective, and see that budgets are moral issues, education policy is a moral issue, economic and tax policy are moral issues, these extreme policies harm us all. And what we've seen in North Carolina and other parts of the country is, without the extremists, subtly claim on the feet of the working class white people. We've seen ultra-conservative politicians and their donors adopting a divide and conquer strategy, causing many people to vote against their own self-interest. Our job is to unpack the truth about these extreme policies and how they adversely impact all people. Our goal is to be a catalyst for a broader debate and a moral conversation about public policy that places the common good, our deepest moral values, our deepest constitutional values, at the center of our work. We must have a society that articulates the connection between the moral call for justice and the constitutional call for the common good. When we operate from these two chief pillars of our democracy, we can in fact create new movements that can change from each state up. As we know, movements are built from Montgomery up, not from D.C. down. We can change from the bottom up. We can change what's happening in states. We can change what's happening and challenge what's happening in these state houses. We can build people together. We can change southern states. Thereby, we can change America. We're in this for the long haul. We are operating from a place of love and hope and deep optimism. We believe that Americans are better than this extremism, and we believe a moral movement gives them a place to stand and articulate a different way and a better way, and to call all of us from the low ground of division and discrimination to the higher ground of justice and love and our deepest moral values. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Reverend Barber. This is Dave Johnson, and we're going to have questions. Now, I believe that everybody's muted, but if you want to ask a question, hit *6. That will unmute your phone and ask a question. And just go ahead. So is anybody out there ready with a question? Remember, hit *6 to unmute yourself. It is not a cue, so hit *6 and talk.
Hi, this is Peter Montgomery. I was interested in hearing from Reverend Barber what kind of response you've gotten to a call for participation from outside North Carolina, from the rest of the country.
Well, we're getting a tremendous call. The first thing we're saying to people is organize in your state, because these have to be led from the state. That's why I went to Georgia to support. But I told Georgia it is critical that you lead it from Georgia up. What we hope this March or February will do, like Selma did, it will send a signal around the country that if these other legislators in other southern states start this kind of extremism, this is what they're going to face in their state. One of the clear calls, we're saying to people, there are a lot of people from North Carolina that are out of North Carolina now. We're saying, come home. Come home. You know, when we first started this, the governor called, they called us morons the day that even bishops of churches were marching. They called us outsiders. They found out that 98% of the people who were participating in our money was right here in North Carolina. And then they basically, you know, said we were a bunch of leftists. And when the Civitas group is funded by our folk, put all of our pictures and our residents and our jobs and our voting records and telephone numbers online using the tactic of the Mississippi Sovereign Commission, they had to admit that a high number of the people were independents and a large number were Republicans. So the reality is our opponents, if you will, are trapped in a kind of linguistic trauma. They don't know what to do with this moral movement because when a reporter says you cut 500,000 people from Medicaid when the money was available, you believe that's the moral thing to do. The only thing they can do is call names and try to disregard. They cannot debate it. So the answer to your question is we're getting tremendous response. If people are committed to nonviolence and committed to this deeply kind of moral argument, we want you to come. You know, at our rallies, we tell people we're not here to castigate and to curse and to do those kinds of things. We have something more powerful. We've got truth. We've got justice. We've got the facts. We've got our deepest moral and constitutional values. And so people are responding. I've been in a number of places, from California to Union Theological Seminary to Princeton to Boston to Georgia, South Carolina yesterday, and people are coming. And we're saying don't just come to march with us, but come and see what we've done. Come and see how it's grown. And if there are lessons that you can take from here, take it back home and mobilize, because the transformation in America, for those of us who believe in the deepest moral values, has to be state by state, indigenously led, locally led, state-based led. Nobody will be able to helicopter in and do this for us. We must do it like it was done in the past, state by state from the bottom up.
Good afternoon, Dr. Barber. This is Lynn Paramore, and I wanted to know if you could say a few words on what makes this movement distinct from other activity we've seen in the last couple of years, i.e. the Occupy movement.
Well, several things. By the way, let me just say we know of about 18 states that are planning to come or send representatives. One of the differences, I don't necessarily want to do a compare. I think movements, the river of justice is like that. It's a river that's ever flowing, and all movements kind of flow in each other. We learn from each other. Each movement has its importance. I think in the time we try to, you know, evaluate movements in vacuums, but the reality is they all have importance. Like Occupy was important because it lifted up something that Dr. King said in 1957 in a sermon in Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. He talked about the 1% dominated the 99% in a sermon called Paul's Letter to American Christians. This is 1957. So there's really nothing new under the sun. But what is distinct about moral money is, number one, it is not something that just popped up. We've been doing the hard, paid work of organizing for more than 7 years, and I just started thousands on Jones G. Teagle's Coalition. We had over 160 partners. We have built a movement that's state-based, that's anti-racist, anti-poverty, deeply moral, deeply constitutional. We've been fighting even before Republicans got in office. We were marching on the General Assembly. We were challenging Democrats. So we have a deep amount of character because we didn't just wait until, you know, Republicans or what I like to say extremists, because many of these people I don't believe are Republicans. We found a lot of Republicans that don't agree with them. The other thing about it is that it didn't just happen spontaneously. You know, we didn't just run in and do civil disobedience. We followed the tenets of civil disobedience. We tried to talk to the governor. We offered to work with him. We said to the governor, if you'll focus on economic sustainability and poverty and labor rights, education equality for all, health care for all, addressing the disparities in the criminal justice system, defending and expanding voting rights, women's rights, LGBT rights, immigration rights. We didn't care what his party was. We would stand there and support him. He in turn told us that if we didn't criticize him, he would meet with us. And he began this track down this extreme road. He allowed Berger and Tillis and our Pope to push him. First 50 days, most of the things I mentioned were passed. But it was in April, during the time we were remembering Bloody Sunday, that they rolled out, even before Michelle became, this massive voter suppression law. And I say to the bloggers, please don't say voter ID law. It's not about voter ID. It's so much broader than that. And it's so much more regressive than that. And it was in that moment when they did that that we decided that they were on a track of extremism that was getting worse. We had to do something to raise the moral and constitutional critique. We hoped that we could change their conscience, but we knew if we didn't change theirs, we had to pull what they were doing in the dark into the light and shake the conscience of the nation, of the state. And that's why 17 of us went on April the 29th to pray, sing, and to challenge what they were doing. They chose to arrest us. We refused to give up our constitutional right. And from there, it went from 17 to nearly 15,000 by the time we left Raleigh. And then we've had numerous. We're now well over 30 Mall Mondays across the state of North Carolina. So what makes it different is its character, its intensity, its focus on the state up, its agenda-based, the fact that it is rooted in this model of fusion coalition politics that comes up out of the first and third reconstructions in America, and that it is something that we've been committed to as a marathon and not just a sprint.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello. This is Adele Stan of RHRealityCheck.org, and my question is, I understand that yours is a coalition of both church groups and secular groups, but I have a sort of a broader movement question, which is that, you know, here in the centers of media of Washington, D.C. and in New York, there has been much hand-wringing over the years over the ineffectualness, the weakness, people say, of the mainline churches, of progressive churches and religion in general. Do you see in this movement a sort of revival of these more mainline and progressive religious houses of worship?
Well, many people have described it as that. You know, we have Christian, we have Muslim, we have Jewish, we have Universalist. We even have people who are not of faith, but they agree with the deep moral tradition of faith, particularly as it relates to the issue of how we deal with injustice and poverty. And they also agree with the deep moral issues in our Constitution. I do think we're in the middle of a kind of revival. It's a revival of values. You know, people have become so weary of the extreme right-wing so-called Christian interpretation of morality that in some ways, took the forefront. And in some ways, sometimes the media allowed it, because oftentimes when the media would debate moral issues, they would put somebody, say, like Franklin Graham on the TV and then have them debate someone who was an atheist. Part of the matter, what we should have been doing is having Franklin Graham have to debate someone like me or someone like the other ministers in our movement who are evangelical, but we're evangelical from the perspective of the social gospel, or like Dr. King, or in the liberation theology tradition, because then what you have is a true contrast. You have a contrast between the narrow notion that all that morality is about is abortion, homosexuality, and prayer in the schools, which do not have major focus in any of our scriptures. Most of the focus that's there is only about four or five, maybe six scriptures, and many of them are misinterpreted. And on top of that, none of those scriptures give you a license to hate people, hurt people, harm people. But when you flip it over, as my good friend Jim Wallace says with Sojourners, and we talk about often, there are more than 300 scriptures that deal with the issue of how do you treat the sick, how do you treat the poor, how do you treat the vulnerable, how do you treat the stranger, how do you treat the immigrant. And not from the perspective of personal charity, but from the perspective of public policy. And so there is a kind of revival, a reclaiming of that tradition that has been lost, that's been intentionally, I believe, dampened ever since the days of Martin King and others. And people are just so thankful. Many people said Moral Monday was like going to church on Monday, but it was about what they had always hoped, that there would be a voice that would stand up and say, wait a minute, how is it that you claim to be conservative and you say so little about what the scriptures say so much about, and so much about what the scriptures say so little about? How is it you claim to be conservative And when it comes to values, how we treat the poor, how we treat the sick, how we treat the least of these, how we shape public policy from the bottom up, you have nothing to say about that. Not anything. But you claim to be conservative, and you're not even conserving the essence or the major values of any of our major faith traditions. So in a real sense, I do think that, yes, it is a kind of revival. And it's the kind of revival that will always take place in America when extremists go too far. When people just decide that their whole goal in life is to use public policies to hurt, harm, and to hinder other folk from developing. There's something deep within our soul and our character as a nation that will that recoils at that and says, no. And that's what we see happening here in the state.
Thank you.
People with questions, you might be on mute. Hit star 6. Otherwise, just ask your question.
Roger, one of the bloggers sent us a little text here, and I want to just mention it about this whole notion of Reconstruction. I have a piece out on the web called The Third Story of America, called The Third Reconstruction. I'm going to ask your bloggers to take a look at it, maybe link it to their stories. And we're going to send to you, Roger, a piece that has all of our video promos, the announcement about tomorrow March, what it is, that you can forward to bloggers, and people ask, can they help? We can ask by telling people, especially the folks you reach in North Carolina, to come, and those that have a connection to come. And if you want to help us and can't come, you can go to our website, which Roger will send you an email. People can get them a $5, $10, $15 donation right through PayPal. But this reconstruction is critical, where we need to a conversation on. In 1868, we began the first reconstruction in the South. Blacks and whites came together, took over all of the major Southern legislatures, progressive whites, Abraham Lincoln Republicans, and blacks. And what did they do? They began immediately to rewrite voting rights laws, education laws, labor laws, tax policy, and even some labor laws in favor of progress. Within 2 or 3 years, there was a direct fight back. They called it the Redemption Movement. And the theory of that Redemption Movement was to take back America, because this fusion politics of blacks and white men working together was changing America in fundamental ways. And they launched an all-out attack. It first started with voting rights. Then they reshaped the courts. Then they got the courts in the Supreme Court to overturn the civil rights laws. And by 1896, you end up with Plessy versus Ferguson. In 1898, in North Carolina, you end up with a riot that runs black and white elected officials out of office, Roger. And it ends the first Reconstruction. The second Reconstruction is 1954, Brown decision. And after the Brown decision that undermines Plessy, think about what follows that. Blacks, whites, Latinos, women all come together, poor and wealthy come together. You get poverty, war on poverty. You get Civil Rights Act of 64, Voting Rights Act of 65. You get an appreciation for changing society in a way that's more just. Within 13 years, what do you have? A direct attack on this Reconstruction called the White Southern Strategy, developed by Kevin DeSilla, later on articulated by Lee Atwater as the way to talk about in code. So the new codes became force busting, states' rights, cutting taxes, and Lee Atwater admitted all of those were code words for policies that would hurt minorities and poor people the most. So there was a direct attack on all of the principles, voting rights, education policy, tax policy, fair labor policies, changing the criminal justice system. And effectively, the White Southern Strategy works, and by 1968, not all our leaders did, but the movement is in a sense dead, and by 1980, the strategy to lock up the South is so strong, Ronald Reagan makes one of his announcements for president in Philadelphia, Mississippi, and he uses the language and the tenets and the code words of the White Southern Strategy. Then President Obama wins in 2008. But it's not President Obama per se, it's the electorate in the South that was broad, that was deep, that was diverse, that was black, that was white, Latino, LGBT, labor, coming together. And we win in places like Florida and South Carolina in a primary, and Virginia and North Carolina in the general election. These are states that tended to be locked up, but that new electorate broke through the so-called solid South and the white Southern strategy. And we believe, and many historians I've talked to, believe that this signaled the possibility of a third Reconstruction. What did you see? We did not see a 30-year wait like in the 1800s or a 13-year wait in the 1960s. We saw a direct attack almost immediately. And the attack was on voting rights, progressive policy, labor rights, and educational policy. So in a real sense, the regressive extremists are operating out of fear because they see the demographics have shifted. Attitudes have shifted. If we began to have a different conversation, the South is no longer solid. North Carolina make up 23% of African Americans make up the North Carolina electorate. That means you get a little bit over 20% of whites to vote their future, not their fear. It's a different day. 33% of African Americans in Mississippi. Over 23% in Georgia. So building these new coalitions is the key to changing the South. That's the key to changing America. We see the possibility of a future. They're trying to stop a future that will not be stopped. And if we understand this extremism, then we understand we're not being fought because of our weakness. We are, in fact, being challenged because of our strength. And if we know that, we won't give up. We won't be depressed. We will build these coalitions, build these movements, and fight back.
Reverend Barber, thank you very much. We will get that email out to everybody who we've invited to this call. And let me remind everybody that the email you got to get onto this call has links to all of the important organizations, the NAACP and the HKONJ.com coalition, where you can find basic information about both background and the February 8th demonstration. It's, as you can tell, this is a crucial battleground in a crucial state. It is the wave of the future that the movement is running on, but that doesn't mean that it's not a struggle. We've got to win, and we've got to make sure that February 8th is a big event in the long battle to take back the South, to take back our country. So does anybody have any urgent additional questions? Otherwise, we want to thank you again, Reverend Barber, for all you're doing and for being with us today.
And this is Dave Johnson. We will have a recording of this call available. Contact me, and I'll have it in a post soon at ourfuture.org. Reverend Barber?
Thank you so much, Roger, and thank both of you. This is tremendous. I give you a thank you on behalf of thousands of people across the state. And, you know, we're up against some things. We got some challenges. I don't normally ask much about resources because we walk on faith, but I do say to the bloggers, if you have people that want to help that can't come, please send them to our website. If they give a small donation, $5, $10, $20, it would mean so much to help us fight against. And we're not just fighting. We're going to up from the wind because as Dr. King said, the Moloch of the universe might be long, but it will always bend towards justice. God bless you. I love you. Forward together, not one step back.
Not one step back. Thank you, sir. And we'll see you on February 8th in Raleigh.
Thanks.
Thanks to everybody who called in.